Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
North Dakota, many of you know, is a red state with a very socialist institution, the Bank of North Dakota and the Mill and Elevator. Would they be created today? Maybe unlikely. But I think that we have now become such a part of the state and such a part of the economic efforts that you would be hard-pressed to do away with the bank. It is really ingrained as part of the state of North Dakota and our history. And the fact is, you know, it works. We have a unique model that may not be the same model that other states choose to implement. But for BND, it works, and it works well.
That's one of our featured guests today on It's Our Money, the man who runs the only public bank in America, Eric Hardmire, talking about the unique nature of his bank and how it has served the people of North Dakota and their bankers for over 100 years. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and chair emeritus of the Public Banking Institute. Today's program will give you an unprecedented look into how public banking is working in both the United States and in Germany, where it has an over 200-year history of success in driving and securing one of the most productive economies in the world, that of Germany. Germany's Sparkassen public savings banks have been the stalwart backbone of that nation's economy and represents what could be possible in the United States, as the initiatives to create public banks at the state and municipal levels build increasing support around the country. It's quite a remarkable economic and political movement that's underway toward building public institutions that are framed for democracy, ones in which public interest and public will get embodied into the core point of these institutions' existences. We live in a very dynamic time for money, generally, with broad new awareness ranging from demythologizing notions of scarcity and debt, the realization that banks should be public utilities, and that we've abrogated the public's sovereign right to control who issues and controls it, also the emergence of digital currencies and even community currencies. All these are topics circulating in this broadening discussion about money and banking. So today we have quite a unique opportunity to hear firsthand from the leading and only public banker in the country who will describe the bank's background, as you know, now over 100 years old. The political and economic dynamics also of that bank are discussed, and the impact that the current keen interest in public banking has had on his work and role. We're grateful to New York State Senator James Sanders for sharing this audio, which was taken from an online webinar that the senator hosted recently, in which Ellen and I were featured guests. Later in the program, we have another very special conversation with Professor Mark Cassell of Kent State University, who has completed a book on the German Sparkassen banks, who are the predecessor model that we at PBI, the Public Banking Institute, typically use to represent the power of locally owned public financial institutions. But now let's visit with Ellen and hear about what's going on around the country with public banking. Well, Ellen, I'm excited about today's program because we talk about public banking all the time, and especially on this program, we're focusing on all the great new developments that are happening. Today's conversation with President Eric Hardmire of BND is a very special opportunity to hear about how that bank operates. But golly, around the country, much is happening.
Yes, just this year in 2021, 16 new bills for public banking of one sort or another have been filed. These are state and local bills. So this is in eight different states. So there are six states that have bills for state-owned banks. That's Massachusetts, where there are two bills, New Mexico, two bills, New York, two bills, Oregon, Washington, and Hawaii. And then three bills for facilitating the formation of public banks. That's New York and Oregon has three of them. And one for a feasibility study, that's Hawaii. And then two bills for city-owned banks in Philadelphia and San Francisco.
But so you left out New Mexico.
No, I said New Mexico. I did. No, two bills in New Mexico.
Okay.
Okay, I said it, I think.
It's happening.
Yeah, so a lot of action. And then, of course, we have three federal bills that were filed last year that we've discussed before here. And then we have two, New Jersey is moving right along on their state-owned bank bill. And in California, the California Public Banking Alliance is pushing for another bill to convert the infrastructure bank into a state-owned bank. So that's supposed to be filed this year as well. We had one bill last year to that effect, but it was withdrawn and now they're going to do it again. So a lot of action on the public banking front. And then you might ask, why is that? at least one reason is that the 2020 crisis, the lockdowns and the pandemic, et cetera, have just shown a light on how insufficient our current system is and how much we really do need to overhaul the system. Trillions of dollars were put out into the economy supposedly for relief for the pandemic. And in fact, it basically went to big corporations and big investors. The rich got richer and the poor got poorer. And why was that? Because the money goes first to the big banks and they have a profit motive. Their goal is to make as much money as they can for their investors. And they're just not interested in local loans or the unbanked and underbanked or lending to small businesses or even lending to municipalities. The banks and the rating agencies are aligned and the rating agencies have rated municipalities as worse credit risks than corporations, although they're really only 1/40th as likely. If you track their course over the last 20 years, I think they're only 1/40th as likely to go bankrupt as a corporation, including the big AAA corporations. Estates are not allowed to go bankrupt at all, so they're totally safe. And then even cities, many states don't allow their cities to go bankrupt. So the whole system is rigged against municipalities and against getting the money into the hands of small businesses, which is where most of the jobs are, or jobs have been lost now, or into the hands of individuals.
As you say, it's fixed. The system is fixed against us, rigged really against public interest and in favor of the private profits that are part of the financial system that we basically handed over to private interests 100 years ago. So hearing from Eric Hardmire, you know, he talks about how this system, even though it represents a socialist type of institution in a very red conservative state, has become integrated into the core stability of its economy and in the banking environment also, that the bankers are so dependent and interactive with the Bank of North Dakota. So we are at an exciting time in American monetary history. Let's go hear what President Eric Hardmire has to say about the Bank of North Dakota.
We are at a cusp where people are becoming aware that we need a new system and we've got a lot of momentum behind it.
Okay, thanks. We'll get on with Eric.
Thank you.
You Now, we're very pleased to be able to share comments made by Eric Hardmire, the president of the Bank of North Dakota, America's only public bank at the moment, from a presentation that he made to a webinar recently that was hosted by New York State Senator James Sanders, who is leading an effort in New York to create a state bank.
The Bank of North Dakota has a history of 100 years. We were created as part of the progressive movement that swept at least the upper Midwest back in the 1900s, early 1900s. North Dakota was led by a very charismatic individual by the name of A.C. Townley, who gathered up groups of disgruntled farmers, was successful in creating a third political party in the state of North Dakota called the Nonpartisan League. They gained control of the legislature and then passed sweeping industrial resolutions that created not only the Bank of North Dakota, but it also created what is now known as the State Mill and Elevator, which is the largest single mill and elevator in the country. Along with that was what is now called workforce safety and insurance. So at the time, 100 years ago, you know, some of the discontent that I'm hearing in New York, it was similar to what we were experiencing in North Dakota. Deep disregard and skepticism of the big, large money center banks, the big elevators, out-of-state entities that really, you know, I felt at the time was controlling North Dakota's destiny. And so that really was the idea of this progressive movement, was for North Dakota to take control of its own destiny by creating its own ability to lend money and by the ability to market and add value to grain. And so here we are 100 years later. I have been personally at the bank for 35 years. I have been president of the bank for 21 years. When I came to the bank in 1985, it was about a $600 million bank. Today, we are about an $8 billion bank. We have set record profits for the last 16 years. 2020 was not as successful because of issues, as you all are aware of, but it was still the top five most successful year that we've had. Our mission, you know, 100 years ago, remains as it is today, and that is to finance economic development throughout the state of North Dakota. So that's our primary mission. And with that, you know, we are giving a lot of latitude to creating programs and to work with the business community and the banking community to really hone in on how those are best met. So let me describe a little bit about how the bank works and some of our responses, how we think about economic development, how we go about doing it. And also let me just say at the very front end of this, I will not advocate publicly for this model, although I have spoken to at least 30 to 40 different states. I've been to numerous states talking about this. I find that this is a contentious issue wherever I go, the idea of a public bank, and I leave it up to the local jurisdictions to find out whether this is something that they are interested in going forward with or not. So I will not advocate, but I will educate. And for North Dakota, many of you know, is a red state with a very socialist institution, the Bank of North Dakota and the Mill and Elevator. Would they be created today? Maybe unlikely, but I think that we have now become such a part of the state and such a part of the economic efforts that you would be hard-pressed to do away with the bank. In my course of 35 years, I have seen a couple of attempts to stop the bank, to turn it back over to the private sector, but it largely doesn't go anywhere. because I think as you know, you'll hear me describe, it is really ingrained as part of the state of North Dakota and our history. And the fact is, you know, it works. It works very well in our state. We have a unique model that may not be the same model that other states choose to implement if they go forward. But for BND, it works, and it works well. Our model really is, in addition to financing economic development, we also operate as what's called a banker's bank. And that is, we support the local banks. One of the stats that I saw earlier was we have more banks per capita than any other state. And I think largely that may be in case because of the Bank of North Dakota and our ability to help those businesses and those banks leverage the Bank of North Dakota and leverage our assets to go forward. So what is a banker bank? Basically, you know, just like individuals, banks need access to banking services as well. So we do normal things that a correspondent bank would do. We clear checks for our North Dakota banks. We do safekeeping. We do bond accounting. We do Fed funds clearing. We provide liquidity to banks. We provide them Fed funds lines. Earlier it was mentioned Fed funds are Feds sold by the Federal Reserve to banks. We do the very same thing for our North Dakota banks. We buy and sell their liquidity from them. And we have found that over the course of our history, we've grown very close to our North Dakota banks. And in fact, you know, they serve as our delivery channel. The Bank of North Dakota originates very few loans outside of a robust student loan division. Most of our lending is done in participation with a local bank. We believe that economic development is driven locally. Those banks certainly know their customers, know their businesses better than we do. And so what they do is they work with their customer, utilize the Bank of North Dakota's programs, of which we have many that they can choose from. We have programs to help entrepreneurs start up. We have programs for middle market, and we have, you know, programs for large, you know, Fortune 500 companies that are looking to come to North Dakota or to expand in North Dakota. So, you know, we do a little bit of lending in each area. We determine what those areas are by continuing to understand the economic landscape of the state of North Dakota. We visit with economic developers. We visit with bankers, with state officials, to really understand what are the needs in North Dakota. How can we serve those needs? You know, one of the things I was asked to respond to was, you know, how did we do during COVID? What did the Bank of North, what was our role? And I would tell you, you know, similar to what we saw the firefighters do, you know, after 9/11, you know, that's how Bank of North Dakota thinks of itself, is we rush in to where the disasters are to see where we can help. Most banks would take a very hands-off approach, a very conservative approach, kind of let the dust settle, figure out where they should play. BND, on the other hand, because of the unique nature of what we do, that we are instrumental, I think, in the success of our economy. We are used to really getting in, rolling up our sleeves, finding out what the needs are, and then meeting those needs. Now that doesn't mean that we're not going to do our homework. In the case of COVID, we offered three different programs to small businesses outside of, you know, the PPP program. We recognize, having dealt with financing disasters for, you know, 30 to 40 years, that there is a role for the bank. But what we didn't want to do, and what we will not do, is duplicate efforts. If we understand that the federal government, the SBA, FEMA, has a role to play in providing assistance to local businesses, we're not going to come in and duplicate that effort. Instead, we're going to see where the gaps arise and seek to fill those. So that is really our mantra is to be patient and to understand where the needs are so as to be as efficient as possible. I've been asked to talk a little bit about infrastructure. The Bank of North Dakota is a state agency on top of being, a state-owned bank. So I am the head of an agency, the Bank of North Dakota. I go to the legislature every 2 years when they meet. I present a budget that gets approved. And along with our programs that we develop on our own, we also have state-initiated programs that legislators may devise and ask for us to work on. Infrastructure has become a significant part of our growth of the state as we've gone through several energy boom and bust cycles, building out our infrastructure, whether it's roads, buildings, or water projects, flood diversion. BND plays a role in administering, billions of dollars worth of programs to the state. We also act as the state agency's bank. So we will provide liquidity to other state agencies that need it. Our Department of Emergency Services knows that if they need quick access to money, overnight, we can get them money to meet their needs. There's a lot of different directions that I could go. I'd be interested really in answering questions that you may have. I know that there are some questions that I get in every one of these. And let me just answer a few of those off the bat, and then I'm happy to take questions. First of all, are we FDIC regulated? Are we insured by FDIC? The answer is no, we are not. We're not regulated by any OCC, FDIC, any entity at all. In fact, we are examined by the state Department of Financial Institutions, but they do not have any authority or exercise power to do any types of mitigation at the bank. How are we funded? Well, the Bank of North Dakota is unique and different from other states in that we have what's called a treasurer that is very weak in its duties that it has compared to other states. By law, all deposits collected by the state, all income tax, all fees, all sales tax is automatically deposited at the Bank of North Dakota. Those become our core deposits. That becomes the nucleus of our funding and how we have the ability to make loans to other entities. We also have access to the Federal Reserve. We are a member of the Federal Reserve. We are a member of the Federal Home Loan Bank. We have the authority to issue bonds if need be. But we have at this point, sufficient liquidity and alternative funding sources to fund all of our needs. We also, because of our profits, we are able and willing to provide what's called a dividend back to the state. So every 2 years, we get into a discussion with the legislature on what might be an appropriate amount of our income or our dividends to transfer back to the state. Today, we are contemplating a 50% dividend philosophy, which means that 50% of our dividends could be transferred to the state. 50% of our profits, I should say, could be transferred to the state. The rest is built for capital growth. And today, the Bank of North Dakota enjoys a strong capital position of 12%. Our return on equity is upwards of 15%. It's been as high as 22%. And so with that, why don't I stop, answer a few questions, and we can see where it goes from there.
Wow, it's great to have to be talking to you, Eric Hardemeyer, our hero. And it was a great presentation. Thanks, everybody. So you said that if an agency needs liquidity, you provide it. What interest rate is that, and is that a loan, or you know, what are the terms for that sort of loan?
Yeah. So it would be really what we use as an index for state agencies is we use the Fed rate. Today that's 0.25%, and we mark it up some to meet our overhead costs. So state agencies borrow at a rate from us somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.25 to 1.5%. I should say that, not only do we provide a low interest rate to state agencies, but one of the other things that we do is we are and have been in the student loan business. We believe that education is a important part of the evolution of the state of North Dakota, the economic development of the state of North Dakota. And so we have provided student loans to our residents, since the early 60s. In fact, we were the first state, we were the first bank to make a federally insured student loan in the nation. And today, you've heard of SoFi. The Bank of North Dakota actually was the first to offer a total student loan refinance program. And today we lend money to student loan borrowers at a rate of 1.75%.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they have options of fixed or variable rate. So the nature of the bank, it's low cost of money. It's something that we do utilize to encourage economic activity. And we do, provide that to our borrowers as well. We just simply take our cost, add something for overhead and profit, and get the money out as inexpensively as we can.
And where do you get the liquidity? Do you get it from the Fed? Do you get it from the Federal Home Loan Bank, or you've just got it there in your deposit base?
Well, today, along with a lot of other banks across the country, banks today seem to be flush with deposits. But as I said, our nucleus of our deposit, our core deposits, come from state tax collections, income tax, sales tax, fees. But we do, as I said, have access to the Federal Home Loan Bank, the Federal Reserve. Our banks today are flush with liquidity. So they are selling us their excess liquidity. We have $1 billion of deposits from other banks on our books today.
That's Eric Hardemeyer, the president of the Bank of North Dakota, speaking to a webinar hosted by New York State Senator James Sanders, who's leading an effort to establish a New York State public bank. Our thanks to both Eric Hardemeyer and Senator Sanders.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Mark Cassell, who is a professor of political science at Kent State University in Ohio, and has written a very informative book called Banking on the State, The Political Economy of Public Savings Banks, which is basically about the Sparkassen in Germany. And most of our listeners will know something about the Sparkassen because, we're all interested in public banking. Okay, so it's great to talk to you, Mark. You posed in your book this enigma of why is it that these small banks have done so well and kept Germany thriving when it's not even because they're publicly owned, obviously, because other publicly owned banks, for example, in Spain, failed during the financial crisis, but the Sparkassen just keep going strong. So tell us about your book and, what you found and all that.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's kind of the question of the book. So you have these, Germany has three types of banks. It's got cooperatives, it's got private banks, and it has public banks. And a big part of Germany's banking system are these small regional public savings banks. They make up the lion's share of all lending to manufacturing. They make up about 70% of all loans to businesses that are sort of small, mid-sized enterprises in Germany. They make up the largest share of all accounts in Germany. About 90 million people in Germany have accounts with the Sparkassen. So, and what's interesting about these entities is that they are hyper-local. In fact, they're so local that there's 385 of them. They're so local that they aren't actually able to do business outside of their region. They are by law required to only do business in their region. And their region is about the size of a relatively small county in the United States. So that gives you a sort of a sense, maybe, you know, an area that it maybe has between 50 and 150,000 people. That's the size that they operate in. And in fact, by law, they're actually not allowed to operate outside that region because that activity would be competing with other Sparkassen that are located in a different region. So they're very, very hyper-local. And the question for this book and for my project was really, how the heck are these institutions even surviving? How do we even have these institutions? Because if you look, as you said, Ellen, you look around Europe, you used to have these regional savings banks all over the place. And a lot of them went away. In fact, we know from the United States experience, you know, we used to have community banks everywhere. And community banks have gone the way of the dodo bird. I mean, they, you know, they're like on the verge of extinction because, you know, because of the efforts by large corporate banks, private banks that have really exercised their lobbying power to enact rules that basically make community banks very, very difficult to survive. So the question for this book was, what enables these institutions to survive? That's what drove the book and that's what drove my research. And I look at really three reasons that they're able to survive. The first is that they just add value to the local community. It's probably the most simple explanation and the most obvious, but it's also the most real. The savings banks, the reason that they do so well is because they add value to local small businesses in their region. What that value means is, first of all, capital, right? So they're able to provide a steady flow of capital even during times of crises. And if you look, for example, at the period of the financial crisis, lending from Sparkassen, from these regional small public banks, stayed relatively steady. And then actually there was an uptick during the financial crisis. So they actually increased their lending during the financial crisis at the very moment that small mid-sized enterprises needed it most. And actually a lot of enterprises that have typically accounts with private banks, public banks, cooperative banks, shifted from private banks to public banks because of the stability of the flow of capital. The other value added that savings banks offer firms is information. You know, if you're the main lender in your area, you don't just make loans to one business, you make loans to lots and lots of businesses. And so you have information. And so if you're a company, maybe you're thinking about sending up a small manufacturing plant, you go to your public savings bank, that public savings bank knows all about your competitors. It knows, more importantly, it knows a lot about your suppliers. It knows where your customers are. And so it's an important source of information. And so the first explanation is value added. That's just plain and simple. The second reason these institutions survive and thrive is actually administrative. We think of administration as being really boring, you know, public administration, it kind of makes your eyes glaze. But in truth, you know, the fact that they are part of a network. All savings banks, even though they operate independently, they're part of a network. So they're part of a cohesive network of not only 385 savings banks, but also a number of larger public state level banks and a variety of other institutions. And that large network allows for savings banks, even these little itty bitty savings banks, to benefit from economies of scale. What that means in practice is that you can be a small entity and yet reap the benefits of marketing, of technology, right? So there's a lot of back-end in banking. And so these small institutions can benefit from the technological investments in the back-end in technology, regulatory compliance. As regulations go up, they become more costly. Well, a small savings bank is able to basically tap into a larger network to spread some of those costs out over a much larger group. And finally, the network, basically, it allows for savings banks to kind of oversee each other. So rather than sort of operate independently of one another, savings banks actually have an incentive, because they share joint liability with each other, they have an incentive to oversee each other. And so regulatory compliance becomes more efficient and a lot more effective. So it's, we're talking value-added administration. And then thirdly, politics. The one of the things that stands out is that savings banks do really well, or have done really well, not out of accident or by force of nature, but because of their very deliberate and effective use of politics. They're not just the recipients of public policy. They know, just like large corporate banks know, they are there to try to shape public policy. And they do that in a variety of different ways. At the local level, they're very effective in building bonds with their local community and local citizens. So they, one of the things that they do that's very effective is that they contribute to the civic life of all the of the region in which they're located. They give to soccer teams and to bands and to, you know, they participate in the civic life of the community. And that creates a bond between the savings bank and the local community, so that even if the cost of saving at that institution goes up and fees go up, people are still passionately loyal to their local savings bank. At the state and local level, at the state and national level, they are very effective in part because the local political leaders sit on the supervisory board of savings banks. Those local political leaders also serve in political parties that are represented at the higher levels. And oftentimes, if you're, say, a state or federal politician, the likelihood is that you got your feet wet. You learned about banking in part because of your experience at the regional public savings banks. So they are very effective in utilizing, savings banks are very effective, I think, in developing relations with policymakers at every single level of government, including, frankly, at the European level. They've been very, very effective in sort of exercising leverage well beyond any money or any money spent on lobbying that's put in that other corporate banks, for example, private banks put in. There was a great statistic in my book about the amount of money spent in Brussels, the seat of the European Union, by private banks versus public banks. And the amount is staggering. The amount of money that private companies and private lobbying groups spend on behalf of private banks is just astronomical. The public savings banks are actually very, very small in comparison. And yet, in part because their public savings banks have this link at every level of government, you know, fundamentally they're about local regional banking, and they utilize that across the entire country to exercise influence at higher levels where it counts. And so they're actually able to effectively fend off legislation that in other countries, quite frankly, has led to their dismantling.
So I know they've had some problems with the EU regulations, or, you know, they're concerned that the EU regulations will shut them down. But they've managed to stand up, I guess, against them. Is that right?
That's right. I think the biggest issue for public savings banks is the requirement that they adopt a deposit insurance scheme like we have in the United States, like with the FDIC. The European Union, and in particular France, which is a country that's dominated by a small handful of very, very large banks, private banks primarily, the European Union believes that the best of all possible worlds is to have very small numbers of banks and have them be very, very large, because they believe that it's much easier to regulate them. The European Union would like to see Germany, and particularly the public banks in Germany, move away from its so-called institutional protection scheme to a much more conventional scheme of deposit insurance. That would really undermine the value added of German public banks. They recognize that. The value added is that no depositor, not only are deposits guaranteed in Germany's public banking system, but the institutions themselves are guaranteed. So public banks don't go under in Germany. Just in the same way that your police department doesn't go under. If a regional savings bank, for example, would make loans, which they can, they could potentially make loans that go south and go badly. Other savings banks, other members of that network would step in and either recapitalize that institution or merge that institution into a neighboring institution. That's typically the way it often happens. And so it isn't just that the depositors are have their money guaranteed, but the institution itself is guaranteed. And that's very different from a private bank. And so the public savings bank system is very wary of efforts by the European Union to get rid of their institutional protection scheme, which gives them a lot of benefits. So it gives them a lot of comparative advantages, and they don't want to lose that.
Yeah, that's great. Very interesting. I know that in your book, you had 10 takeaways.
Sure, I can talk a little bit about that. First is that there, you know, not all public banks are the same, right? So I know that in the United States, there are lots of efforts at creating a public bank. We obviously have the one in North Dakota, and there are obviously important efforts being made in California and New York, but not all public banks are the same. And I think it's important to sort of recognize that there's gonna be a variation in those banks. What Germany's public, the banks that I look at in Germany are, for example, different from, say, development banks, which are oftentimes arms of the state. Germany has development banks, you know, essentially arms of the state, if you will, with, that are developed in order to pursue some sort of public, typically an infrastructure project or some sort of public public good. These tend to be fairly politicized entities, and their goal isn't really profit per se, but just a way to sort of deploy state resources for a particular purpose. Again, typically infrastructure. Germany's public banks, the savings banks that I study are, it's important to recognize, are for-profit institutions with a public purpose. So these are entities that are not about, they are not nonprofits. They are driven by to make profits, but they're not driven to maximize profits. And that's an important distinction. They have a variety of other public purposes, like, for example, expanding savings, helping their local communities in a variety of ways. And so it's always important to sort of, they have an important mission to balance those goals, but they are about addressing all of those goals. So not all banks are the same. What they also show is that public and private goals are compatible. You can have both. You can both be a profit-making entity, but also an entity that cares about your local community. You can do both. You have to, however, make sure that you have some accountability. Just as we have CPAs that are in charge of making sure that the books are clear, you need to make sure that that institution is behaving in a public, in its public mission, that it's actually addressing local needs. So you need to have, for example, in the case of the public savings banks in Germany, you need to have political leaders or at least representatives of local government that at least sit on the supervisory board of an institution to make sure that it actually is in fact operating in the public interest or fulfilling its public mission. But I think the savings banks show that you can do both. You can both pursue a public as well as a private mission. The third is that performance ought to be based on its mission and not just on profits alone. That at the end of the day, something like a public savings bank, there are a variety of goals, there are a variety of purposes, and profits are only one. And so you should be wary of sort of measurements that limit, that are focused strictly on one outcome. The fourth is that public banks improve competition. You know, public, we like, in the United States, we like competition, and so do the Germans. And so any effort that would undermine public banks is viewed as anti-competitive. We sort of think, well, how is that possible? You hear oftentimes critics of public banks saying, oh, we don't want to be like some sort of a Russian or socialist state. Well, it's just the opposite. Actually, in Germany, you not only have 385 public savings banks, but they have lots and lots of branches that are located throughout their region. They increase the amount of competition. They ensure, in fact, that there's banking in every single county in Germany. Even the most rural, unpopulated counties, you still have banking. And so that's really, really important, I think, throughout this story. The other is that public banking is an important economic tool. It's a tool for economic development. So, you know, we in the United States often think of economic development as just about giving tax abatements. I mean, that's like if you ask an economic development director what's their most important tool, they'll say reducing taxes on a specific business. What this study shows and what public banks generally do show is that you can do economic development differently and actually in a more effective way by just making sure that the entities that provide capital to local businesses remain stable and remain viable. That providing capital and having access to capital is one of the most important economic tools that you can give to a local community and its businesses. And public banks are an important part of that. Public banks are also an important source of economic inclusion. I don't want to paint a panacea. I'm not saying that they're the solution to everything. But for example, if you looked at the in Germany, there was the refugee crisis. There's still a refugee crisis. Germany was the target of millions of refugees that were coming in from Syria, from Afghanistan, and many of them located in some of the larger cities and smaller cities throughout Germany. Well, in Germany, a lot of those refugees and the way in which cities provide support to refugees is through banks. No one can do anything in Germany without a bank account. That's just, you can't get social services, you can't get housing subsidies without a bank account. And so banking was essential to the refugee crisis. And the one entity, the one financial institution that stepped up to the plate were the public savings banks. And I'm not saying they did it because they wanted to do it. They did it because by law, they had to do it. And so public savings banks so the refugee crisis is a good example of the way public savings banks are a form of inclusion. And they have been since their creation 200 years ago.
I do have a question about that. Yeah. I know that half of consumer loans approximately are done through the Sparkassen and banks. We've got 16 new bills just this year for public banks in the US, and there are various models and various, but I know one thing that the troops always want are to be able to make loans to small businesses, to whatever, Black businesses, women's businesses, and individuals. But those are your loans, and that's the reason that the big banks don't make those loans, right? So how do the Sparkassen banks avoid bad loans? Or I assume they have the same requirements for prudent lending and collateral and all that sort of thing.
So first of all, Sparkassen or public savings banks are under the same rules as every bank in Germany. So there's no provision, there's no community bank provision. They have to follow the same rules as Deutsche Bank, as Commerzbank, as any bank in Germany. And there are state rules, there are federal rules, and there are European rules. So they're under all of those rules. But these are independent banks. And frankly, they could make bad loans. And some of them do. I mean, it isn't as if public savings banks don't make poor loans. But here's what's a little bit different. First of all, they're local, right? So they're tied to the region. They know the people, they know the businesses, which gives them an advantage, right? So it allows for them to make better loans and frankly, more profitable loans. They can charge a more accurate rate, right? What you charge on a loan reflects the risk. Well, if you have a better understanding of the risk, you're gonna make better choices. That's number one. The other thing, and I think it's not to be underestimated, again, every public savings bank is a member of a large network. Every entity in that network is liable for every other entity. There is a built-in incentive within the network to make sure that all the other members of that network behave prudently. They require their members to share information. And so if you look across 385 savings banks and you recognize that there's one savings bank that's suddenly behaving wildly differently as an outlier, the first thing that the regions will do, the regional entities that oversee some of these savings banks, is they'll say, well, why is that? How is that possible? And they'll look at that entity. And it's still possible that that bank might still decide that they want to behave in an imprudent fashion, but it becomes a lot harder, frankly, in part because the other members of the network are looking out and making sure that that bank is behaving correctly. Now, think about the United States. In our system, it's the exact opposite. If you have a bank, a savings bank or a savings and loan, they have the exact opposite incentive to not reveal if they're making bad loans. They have the exact opposite incentive to make sure that their owners or that the shareholders don't see what's going on in their books. If they're behaving imprudently, they have an incentive to sort of keep that in the dark, in part because it might affect their profitability. And in Germany, it's the exact opposite. And so it's not that it isn't possible for public banks and public savings banks to make bad loans. They can and they do. It's just that, A, they're less likely to because of where they are located in the financial system, and B, because other entities that are members of that network are looking over their shoulder and collecting information about them to make sure that they don't behave imprudently. I would say two final things. One, as I mentioned earlier, I think administration matters. Administration affects the competitiveness of the institutions, right? So again, being part of this network offers the individual savings banks important advantages and important competitive advantages. And we don't usually think about the administration as the source of competition. For example, if you look at statistics like return on equity, Sparkassen, saving public savings banks do far, far better than private banks. If you look at efficiency, public banks are much, much more efficient than private banks. And it's partly because they, again, sort of have this larger network. They reap economies of scale. And it's also in part because, you know, their mission isn't to maximize profits per se. Their mission is to make a profit and maximize these other public goods. And so the focus on, for example, and so as a result, salaries in public savings banks are much lower than salaries in private banks. And that's one of the reasons that they tend to be a lot more efficient. And lastly, what I would say is politics matters. You know, I'm a political scientist. I think about politics. When we think about private entities like banks or firms, we tend to think, we don't usually think about the politics. We think about profit loss statements. We think about maybe business models or entrepreneurship. I'm not saying none of that those things don't matter, but what you also have to, what public banks illustrate that politics matters. These are political entities that are created by governments and they can be destroyed by governments. And I think public savings banks recognize that. They make sure, or they at least have taken steps to ensure that their representation is heard. And I think it's important to sort of recognize banks as being political, not just economic entities.
Another issue that we always have is coming up with, first of all, the money for capital, of course. Maybe they're not forming new public banks yet. The Spark hasn't been around for over
200 years. Yeah.
200 years. Yeah. So maybe they're like the Bank of North Dakota. They've already got their capital. But also, hiring a CEO is very expensive, and that's something you have to have to get your charter. You know, you have to have your executives lined up. And I know I was told that the Sparkassen don't hire seasoned bankers. They hire young people who, you know, they can train their way and they get them used to the idea that this is a public service and they're not in there to make $20 million a year or whatever CEOs of big banks make. How is their salary?
How their salaries rank with other banks? It's much, much lower. But I would say your question is a really good one, Ellen. One has to do with capital and the other has to do with sort of human resources. I'll address the capital one first. Sparkassen are public banks, but they are not owned by their local governments. I think that's an important feature. In the same way, we don't really own our police department or we don't own our fire department. We have them, but we can't sell them. Public savings banks are not really owned per se by their local governments. And frankly, they're not, because of European law, because of European rules, the local governments, for example, don't guarantee anything. They don't receive any explicit or implicit guarantees by their local governments. And they're not capitalized by local governments. It used to be, historically, public savings banks, they got their start through the capitalization by local governments, essentially tax dollars being collected and being used to capitalize their institutions. That's no longer the case. And in fact, cities and counties and other entities can put their money in a local public bank, but they don't have to. You know, public banks compete with other banks. And in fact, you know, in the interviews that I've done with lots and lots of public savings banks in Germany, not all of them really want it because the interest rate is so low that it's sort of a mixed blessing for a lot of them. So today, public savings banks are capital, have enough capital. They're capitalized with their own, with basically deposits that they get. And their business model is very, very boring. Their business model looks a lot like savings and loans pre-1980s. It's based on deposits and it's based on lending. A portion of their earnings now come from commissions, but it's still very, very low. And it's certainly much, much lower than in private banks. Now you ask about human resources. You ask about sort of how do they get CEOs and that sort of thing. One of the things that's really interesting about Sparkassen is that, again, this larger network, this network essentially creates this amazing training system. They have colleges that are dedicated to training young people in finance, in banking, in all aspects of banking. And again, this training reaps benefits from the economies of scale. So, you know, you can have 385 savings and loans, but you don't have to have 385 training systems. You know, their employees can do internships later on, you know, come in at a lower level and get additional training. And that training is usually located, each region of the country specializes in different aspects of banking. And so it's an amazing opportunity for young people who are interested in banking, but don't exactly know what area of banking that they want to get into. And then those people end up being the ones who later on get into higher levels of management, and then finally are able to sort of secure spots as CEOs. What's important in all of this is this kind of socialization process. Again, it's something that we in America, we sort of underestimate. You know, if you talk to friends who work in banks in the United States and ask them, how did you get to your position? I guarantee you that the first thing they'll say is, well, I started here and then I went here and then I went here and then I went here. In other words, the trajectory of promotion in the United States is really hopping from one institution to another. In the savings bank system, you grow within that network. And so you're socialized into that network. And that's really important because the values, the value of making a profit, but also pursuing these public missions is really significant. You need those people to believe in the mission of the public banks. In addition, things like oversight and accountability are really important within the savings, the Sparkassen system, within the Sparkassen network. And those values also get socialized into the training system of the individuals. And so it's really a very, very different model of human resources. And if you talk to CEOs, these are not by any stretch of the imagination sort of progressives or liberal Democrats or however we imagine them. They tend to be fairly conservative people, but they believe in the mission of the public banks. They believe in them, for the most part, CEOs in public savings banks have spent their entire careers in the savings bank system.
Wow, that's great. Well, I think we're running out of time. It's been great talking to you.
It's fun talking to you.
Tell people like where to find your book.
Book is available either through Columbia University Press, or it's available obviously on Amazon. You can purchase it there.
Radio listeners, it's Banking on the State, the Political Economy of Public Savings Banks.
Yep.
Okay.
Ellen, it was great talking to you. Thank you so, so much.
So great talking to you. Thanks, Mark. I've been talking with Mark Cassell, a professor of political economy at Kent State University in Ohio, whose latest book is called Banking on the State, the Political Economy of Public Savings Banks.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.